Well, how was springing forward this morning? Was it so much fun, losing an hour of sleep? The sun was actually brighter than I was expecting it to be, so apparently the morning has been going longer than I realized, because I tend to sleep later than average humans do. So apparently there's more morning left to be used, so that's good. If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand. We want to make sure you got one. And before we start, if you didn't get a handout on your way in, our guys in the back want to make sure you get one. Everybody have one? Everybody's good? Yes? Okay, we're going to be in Jeremiah 52, last chapter of the book. Congratulations, you have made it to the end of the longest book of the Bible, depending on whether you count it in Hebrew or English, but it's the longest, one of the longest books of the Bible, if not the longest book of the Bible, Jeremiah 52. We come to the end. And we don't finish with the other nations, we finish with Israel. Most of this book was written to Israel and to Judah. Israel had been given a special relationship with God, and they failed in that special relationship with God that they were given. Utter failures. They had painted their sin and their idolatry with a religious brush. They had complained that God should have been different than he was. He should have continued to give them grace, regardless of the fact that they were not in a position to receive the blessings of the covenant that they had committed themselves to. And so they failed the law. They failed in the covenant they made with God. They should have listened to the prophets that were sent to them, and they didn't. And all the things that God sent to them, the law, the covenant that they made, the prophecy sent them, they were all good. They were all necessary. They were all important. They were all just. But the people were not good enough. And the thing is, we all fail the law. We all fail the standard that God has given to us. And there's a consequence to it. Now, this chapter, chapter 52, it does not belong to any section in the book. This is not the capstone to the last section of the book, because remember, the last section of the book was about all the other nations. We had talked about Israel and Judah for the entire book, chapters 2 through 45. And the last few chapters, he talked about everybody else, Moab, Edom, Babylon, Egypt. And now we cap the whole book off, chapter 52. And we finish by going backwards a little bit, to the fall and the very relevant demise of Jerusalem. Now, this is very interesting for several reasons, that this book ends with the fall of Jerusalem. One of the reasons is that this is not chronologically the end of all the things that have been covered in the book. We've talked about Jerusalem and Israel for a while, and we almost seem to leave them aside while we could talk about everybody else. But also, the fall of Jerusalem is not the last chronological thing that happens in this book. Remember, after Jerusalem fell, then they left that governor, Gedaliah, in charge, and the people said, we don't want him to be in charge, and so they assassinated him. Then they all went down to Egypt. A whole bunch of things happened after Jerusalem fell, and it's all in this book. So not only are people mentioned after the fall of Jerusalem, and events have been mentioned in this book after the fall of Jerusalem, but the fall of Jerusalem has actually already been covered in this book, in chapter 39. We already talked about it. In that one, we saw how Babylon came, they besieged the people, Zedekiah, the last king, he had been taken, his eyes had been put out. Now, chapter 39 emphasizes something different. It emphasizes how Jeremiah himself was not taken. The captain goes to him and says, what do you want to do? Do you want to stay or do you want to go? How many of you remember that, where Jeremiah gets to choose what he gets to do? Chapter 52 doesn't talk about that, but it still talks about that event. Why are we finishing with this event again? This is a sad, sad, sad moment. One of the worst moments of Israel's entire history since Abraham to the present is the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon. One of its worst moments. And we already talked about it. We already know about it. It's already been covered. We don't need to bring it up again. And yet he chooses to finish the book with it. Now, I've told you before that the book of Jeremiah, because it is chronologically not in order, depending on in history, sometimes the book of Jeremiah has shown up in slightly different orders. For example, the Bible that the New Testament guys would have been using a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And in that particular version of the Bible, Jeremiah, some of the chapters were switched around a little bit. Now, I've looked at that as we've gone through it because sometimes the chapters are together, and that seems odd, and I've gone back and looked at that translation that they used back when Jesus and the apostles were preaching, and those were usually still together. So I capitalized on that. So I went back and looked. Is this the way that Jeremiah has always ended? And it is. This is the way it has always ended. So it's not just by accident. This is by design. This book chooses to bring back up the fall of Jerusalem and end it on a downer. God wants the book to end with this chapter. Why? Because a major theme of the book of Jeremiah is failure. The people were failures. They were given the law, they were given an opportunity, and they failed the law. That's a huge theme in the book. And so it ends by reminding us what they did to themselves. So I want us to look at the first few verses. Look at verse number 1. Zedekiah, verse 1. 1 and 20 years old when he began to reign. Just a young guy. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah, obviously not the same one, of Libna. He did that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim, his brother, had done. For through the anger of the Lord, it came to pass in Jerusalem and Judah, till he had cast them out from his presence, that Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Zedekiah did evil. God's anger was against him. And it is a very fitting end to the book that the Israelites failed in their attempt to be good enough. We do fail. We have failed. And we are not good enough. We have committed to be good enough. We have made decisions to do what is right. We have committed to make a covenant with God, and we have failed. Now, I don't want to belabor this story too much because we are familiar with a lot of the story. So I want to go through the first two points very quickly before we get to the last one, which is very important. We're going to see very quickly how God responds to our failure. Number one, God allows trials. He allows trials. So look at verse number 4. They did evil, and through the anger of the Lord, it came to pass that Babylon came. And what happened? Verse 4. Came to pass in the 9th year of his reign. Remember, he reigned 11 years. In the 9th year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his army, against Jerusalem. They pitched against it. They built forts against it round about. So the city was besieged unto the 11th year of King Zedekiah. In the 4th month, in the 9th day of the month, the famine was sore in the city, so there was no bread for the people of the land. The city was broken up. All the men of war fled. They went forth out of the city by night and by the way, the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden. The Chaldeans were by the city round about, and they went by the way of the plain. What a sad moment. They were besieged for 2 years. It's an age-old way of winning a war. You can't fight against the city. The city is the one that has all the advantages. So you starve them out. You camp around so food cannot go in and out. If you're lucky, you get a hold of their water supply so they don't have water inside, and you just wait. Sometimes you wait for weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years. And for years, then, the soldiers will be sitting outside of the walls. And you eat whatever you have left until there is nothing left to eat. The people fled, even though, it says in parentheses, there was nowhere for them to go because the Babylonians were round about everywhere. Now remember, this was of their own doing. The book of Jeremiah, the longest book in the Bible, continues to remind us that everything that happened to them was of their own doing. It was not God's fault that they were not being blessed. It was their fault. They had chosen to reject God. They had chosen to be idolatrous. They had chosen to push him off. And so their life was hard. It's so odd how we think. We fail God's law, and so we choose to put ourselves outside of his blessings, and then we get mad at God that he doesn't circumvent his own law and try to and just make it good for us. I was just talking to the teenagers on Wednesday. We were talking about worldview, and we talked about we're talking about creation, and we just moved on to the fall. And one thing I said is, when God made man, he gave man a good world with good relationships and perfect resources and perfect opportunities. And he says, here, have dominion over the world and fill it and subdue it. Explore it, take it over, and take care of it. And they had endless opportunities and endless options of what they could do with the good world that God had given to them. But with a law of what they can do, there's also dictates about what they can't do. And he gave them one rule that they weren't supposed to take the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they did. And what happens? They're cursed. And the curses are not haphazard. They're not random. Remember, they're supposed to fill the world, and they're supposed to subdue the world. The first curse, one of the curses on the woman is that she'll have pain in childbearing. So they will still fill the earth. We will, won't we? Because here we are, 8 billion people on the world. But yet filling the world is now hard when it was supposed to not be hard. And man was supposed to subdue the world. We're supposed to take over, take dominion, put the world underneath the dominion of man, use it well. And so what do? They are going to extend the garden, plant and build. But what does he say to Adam? When you go out and work the ground, it's going to work against you. It's going to be hard. There's going to be weeds. So man will still fill the earth and we will still subdue the earth, but what was supposed to be easy is now hard. Why? Because of our own decisions. When God gives us, God makes us and he puts us in his good world, but we have made it harder than it needs to be. Good understanding gives favor, Proverbs 13 says, but the way of transgressors is hard. Adam and Eve had endless opportunities, but now everything that they are still going to do was now hard to do. And the same is true for us. And the same is true for Jerusalem. They were God's people. God gave them a good land. God gave them endless opportunities to enjoy him, and now life was hard. God allows trials when we fail his law. Number two, God allows failures. He allows failures. And this is what I was just saying a minute ago, when we try to do it our own way, we will fail. And we cannot expect God to swoop in and circumvent our bad decisions and make it work out anyway. He has told us beforehand that that's not how it works. Remember, in the law he gave to the children of Israel, he told them before they even got there how the law was going to function. You obey, you'll be blessed. You disobey, you'll be cursed. Those are your options. This is how it's going to go for you. They cannot get mad at him that when they chose to disobey, he didn't just choose to bless them anyway. They failed, and God doesn't undo their own failures. I want you to see a couple things. Letter A, their failure in their attempts to save themselves. Failure in attempts to save ourselves. Failure in our attempts to save ourselves. So what happens? We just talked about the men of war, right? They're in the city and they're running away, but the Babylonians are circumventing them, so there's actually nowhere for them to go. Zedekiah, the king, now realizes the hopelessness of his situation. He could have realized that a year and a half ago, but now he's really at that spot. There is nowhere for them to go. There is no bread in the city. And now I have no soldiers left. So he runs away. But the Babylonians are surrounding the city. Where is he going to go? I don't know exactly what his big plan was, but whatever it was, it didn't work out. Verse 8. The army of the Chaldeans pursued after the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And all his army was scattered from him. They took the king, carried him up unto the king of Babylon to Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him. Zedekiah said, I got this. I'll run away. Everything will be fine. He tries and he gets caught. Now, this is very unlike the way it worked for Hezekiah. Several generations before, Jerusalem was being besieged by the then most powerful nation in the world, which was equally, if not more, ruthless as Babylon. And they had taken over the northern tribes of Israel, and they had come all the way down to Jerusalem, and they were around the city, and there was nowhere for them to go. But Hezekiah was not an evil king. Hezekiah was a good king. He knew who God was. He respected who God was. He feared the Lord. The beginning of his story was a desperate attempt to get his nation back to obeying the law. So when he's at that moment, what does he do? He doesn't know what to do. So rather than trying to handle it himself, like Zedekiah, I'll run away. Hezekiah says, God, I don't know what to do. You're the only one that can save us. Look what he said. I gave you the passage, 2 Kings 19. Look at verse number 14. Hezekiah received the letter. So they're writing back and forth between the Assyrians and Israel, and the guy writes and says, you're all toast. He takes that letter of the hand of the messengers and read it, and Hezekiah went up into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord, and he prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord God of Israel, which dwellest between the cherubims, thou art the God, even thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. Thou hast made heaven and earth. And he prays for a while. Look down at verse number 19. Now therefore, O Lord our God, I beseech thee, save thou us out of his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord God, even thou only. That was Hezekiah's response. We cannot save ourselves. But that's what we do in our life, isn't it? We don't know what to do, so we make a desperate attempt to fix it ourselves. But it doesn't work that way. And when we try to do it that way, it doesn't work. And God lets it play out for us. Lets us see the foolishness of thinking that we are capable of making the world work out our way instead of God's way. This isn't how we normally act. We don't normally act like Hezekiah. We spend our lives trying to save ourselves. But when we forget about the fact that every good thing in our life is a gift from God. We didn't fill our bank account. We didn't give us our house. We didn't give us our job. We didn't make our family well. We didn't build our ministry. Everything that we have in our life is from the Lord. And the moment we try to save ourselves, God was going to allow us to see how that does not bode well for us. Our failure to save, our attempts to save ourselves, letter B, God allows the failure of our families. Failure of our families. Look at verse number 10. The king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. He slew also all the princes of Judah in Riblah. He put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him in chains and carried him to Babylon and put him in prison till the day of his death. This is one of the saddest moments. We've seen this already, though. What he does is after he captures Zedekiah, he's already captured his children. He kills all of his sons in front of him, and then he puts out his eyes so that was the last thing that he saw. Now, Zedekiah, if we remember vaguely, way back, Jeremiah told Zedekiah they were going to lose. Jerusalem was going to fall. It's going to. This is the point that we're at. But the best thing for you, Zedekiah, is to just give in to it and let Babylon take over, because this is what's happening right now. And if you don't, you're not going to win, and it's only going to be worse. Zedekiah hears that. He chooses not to do it, and this is what happens. In fact, the way that Jeremiah puts it, it's almost as if Zedekiah and his family would have been fine if he had just listened. Israel would have been fine if they had just listened, but they didn't. And every time they choose to go their way instead of God's way, it costs them and it costs those around them. Remember the story of Achan, or Achan, if you say it in Hebrew. One video I saw said that. From Joshua 8. So they go to Jericho, and the first city as they go into the promised land, all the spoils belong to the Lord. Interesting principle. You know, God gives to us, but we always give our first fruits to him because we recognize that all of it is from him. And so they're not supposed to take any spoils for themselves. But Achan, he chooses to take some for himself anyway, some gold and a Babylonian garment. So he takes it and he hides it in his tent. There's sin in the camp. They're not blessed for their next battle. They ask God what the problem is, and God points them to the fact that one of the families in the nation of Israel had disobeyed the only command they had so far. And so they narrow it down, and they find Achan's family. Achan's family would have been culpable because they would have known about it. But either way, the whole family was stoned. But we live in such an individualistic society, in the West especially. We see ourselves primarily as individuals and secondarily a part of a group. People in that time, and also people in the East, don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as primarily a member of the group and secondarily an individual. You see this in the Bible, how some people are introduced, not by their name only, but by their name and who their dad is and who their dad's dad is and what family they belong to and what tribe they're from and what city they live in. And we always read through that, and we always chuckle when we read it, don't we? This man, and we all chuckle like, wow, what a completely unnecessary amount of information. But not to them. That is who they are. They're not just whatever their name is. They are his son, and they are his grandson, and they're part of that tribe, and they live in that community. That is who I am. I belong to all those people. And because that's true, the decisions they make affects their dad and their dad's dad and their tribe and their community. But we live in a culture that's so emphasizing our individuality, and not necessarily to a fault, we all just think differently, but by emphasizing how individual we are, we forget the fact that we're not an island. You are not just you. You're your parents' children. It doesn't matter how old you are. You carry their name with you, whether they're even alive or not. You are the parents of your children and your children's children. You have siblings. You have a spouse. You have a workplace. You live in a neighborhood. You have a church. And whether you like it or not, you belong to all of them. And the decisions that you make affects those around you. The Bible tells us that it will. We all see that it does, but we all want to think that it doesn't, so that we can live as we please and feel like there's zero consequences, or at least I'll bear all of them and nobody else will. It does not work that way. When we fail our families. And we fail our families, God lets us see it, because that's what happens. And that goes to the next one, letter C. Lets us see the failures of our communities. The failure of our communities. Our fellows are coming by. If you could drop your attendance slip in, we'd appreciate that. Just so we know who's here this morning. I want you to hop down really quickly. Look at verse 24. I know this is a sad end to the book, but I'm going somewhere with this, and it's important. Verse 24. So after they sack all of Jerusalem, we see the whole nation go with them. Verse 24. The captain of the guard took Seraiah, the chief priest. By the way, not the same one from last chapter who brought the message to Babylon. It would have been a different one. He's a chief priest. The other guy was a quartermaster. Seraiah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, and three keepers of the door. He took also out of the city a eunuch, which had the charge of the men of war, seven men of them that were near the king's person, which were found in the city, the principal scribe of the host, who mustered the people of the land, 80 men of the people of the land that were found in the midst of the city. A lot of people in a lot of positions with a lot of jobs. Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took them, brought them to the king of Babylon, to Riblah. The king of Babylon smote them and put them to death in Riblah in the land of Hamath. Thus, Judah was carried away captive out of his own land. This is the people whom Nebuchadnezzar carried away captive. In the seventh year, 3,000 Jews and 20 and 3. That was the first time that he came. In the 18th year, Nebuchadnezzar, he carried away captive from Jerusalem 830 and 2 persons. That was the second time he came under the reign of Jehoiachin. And in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive of the Jews 740 and 5 persons. That was this time. All the people were 4,600. So he takes everybody else captive. The buildings he burns with fire. The world around them fell apart. And God lets it happen. At the very beginning of the Bible, the people failed. They chose to go their way instead of God's way. In Genesis chapter 6, it describes not the people's lives, it describes the communities in which they live. Their thoughts were evil continually. And what happens to that world? It's overthrown with a flood. I mean, they were prospering, I guess. They had their own system going, but because it was against God's word, it wasn't going to work, it wasn't going to last, it wasn't going to be sustained, and it failed. Of course, that's the next thing that happens, though. You close chapter 9, you have the beautiful story, Noah and his family, there's the rainbow, I'll never flood the earth again. Then you have a genealogy in chapter 10, you have a bunch of people. You open chapter 11, the people are doing the same thing, building the world their way. And you have a community that's working well together, going their direction. They've built a tower that's going to reach into heaven. And so it's all working. It's all functioning, but it's all corrupt. So God scatters their languages, and the community fails again. The community fails when the community tries to build its world its own way. And we shouldn't expect for God to swoop in and somehow make a failing and a corrupt community just end up working out anyway. If a community is not seeking after God, then they are not going to do well. When they take God's world and exercise dominion over it according to their own law instead of God's law, they are destined to fail. And he'll let the economy crumble. He'll let the leadership fail. He'll let the roads and buildings fall. If they're not seeking after God, what do we expect him to do? Make it work anyway? He lets the communities fail. And lastly, and this is very interesting, letter D, God allows the failure of our religion. The failure of our religion. But this shouldn't have happened. I mean, they were still so religious. They were still doing all the stuff. Remember all the way back in chapter 7 through 10, Jeremiah's temple sermon? He went down to the temple and it was filled with people bringing sacrifices. Yes, it was, but remember the temple sermon? He walks in and says, you guys are doing all these things, but it doesn't undo all of the wickedness in your life. You don't get to just live as you please and then go to church and it somehow just undoes it all. That's what he told the people. They didn't listen to him. And what's very interesting about this last chapter is how much and how specifically it emphasizes not just the failure of the leadership and the people, but also of the temple itself. Go backwards. Look at verse number 12. Look at verse 12. In the fifth month, in the 10th day of the month, which was the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Nebuzaradan. That's his captain. That's why he keeps coming up. Captain of the guard, which served the king of Babylon into Jerusalem. And he burned the house of the Lord and the king's house. And all the houses of Jerusalem, and all the houses of the great men burned he with fire. The army of the Chaldeans that were with the captain of the guard break down all the walls of Jerusalem round about. So the king's house, the Lord's house, and everyone else's house, and all the walls. There's nothing standing anymore. Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive certain of the poor people of the city and residue of the people that remained in the city. Those that fell away, that fell to the king of Babylon, and the rest of the multitude. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left certain of the poor of the land for vine dressers and for husbandmen. Now it talks about God's house. The pillars of brass that were in the house of the Lord, and the bases, and the brazen sea that was in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans break, carried all the brass of them to Babylon, outside in the courtyard of the temple and how it was set up. There was a lot of brazen instruments. You had the brazen altar sitting on very large brazen bases and a brazen laver sitting also on large brazen bases. So an intense amount of brass. A lot of tools too. Verse 18, the cauldrons also, the shovels, the snuffers, the bowls, the spoons, all the vessels of brass wherewith they ministered took they away. And the basins, and the fire pans, and the bowls, and the cauldrons, and the candlesticks, and the spoons, and the cups. That which was of gold in gold, and that which was in silver, took the captain of the guard away. The two pillars, one sea, 12 brazen bulls that were under the bases, which King Solomon had made in the house of the Lord. The brass of all these vessels was without weight. There's too much of it, they couldn't count it. Concerning the pillars, the height of one pillar was 18 cubits. The fillet of 12 cubits did compass it, and the thickness thereof of 4 fingers, it was hollow. Chapiter of brass was upon it. The height of one chapiter was 5 cubits, with network of pomegranate upon the chapiters round about, all of brass. The second pillar also, and pomegranates were like unto these. There was 96 pomegranates on a side, and all the pomegranates upon the network were 100 round about. How specific? How unnecessarily specific? Oddly. So. But reading that chapter reminds you of reading through, like, Exodus, where he told them how to build it in the first place. Or Solomon in 1 Kings, where it describes how they built it. Both of those chapters are rejoicing moments, where we get to see all the intricate detail of how the people built God's house. Especially when you read Exodus, because that's what God told them to do. Every single one of these things was something they were supposed to have. The pillars, the laver, the cauldrons, all the tools, the shovels and the snuff dishes, all of those had to do with how they made sacrifices. All of it's gone. And he bothers to tell us about all the individual pieces because it reminds them of all the religious things they would do, all the sacrifices they would perform, all of the rituals that they would go through, and all of which were commanded to them by God to do. So what do you expect? What I expect is for the Babylonians to come in and for God to allow them to take everything else but to let his house stand. That would have been a really good sermon to preach, wouldn't it? There's an easy 3-point outline out of that message, but that's not what happened. Is it? God allows the Babylonians to come. He burns everyone's house, including his own. And it doesn't even just call it the temple. It says the Lord's house. Why does he do that? Shouldn't he reverence his own name by allowing his house to stand? Well, it has been a long time since that house has properly represented him. Well, isn't his presence there? No. No, it's not. And we know it's not because Ezekiel tells us it's not. See, this is the third deportation. When you open the book of Ezekiel in the very first chapter, you find a man who's already in Babylon who went in the second deportation. Babylon has not fallen yet, but people are already in Babylon. And Ezekiel has a vision, a weird vision, of cherubim with wheels under, and there's a firmament above him, and then a guy sitting on a throne, and it's God's presence. And he hears of all the wickedness of Jerusalem and at his temple. Ezekiel has a vision at the temple before Jerusalem falls, a few years before this. And he sees all the wickedness going on in this temple. And he sees God's presence in his cherubim and the angel wheels and the firmament and the throne. He sees it pick up and leave. God was not in that. And when God is not in their religion, he will let their religion crumble too. People, our problem is not that we're not religious enough. Our problem is that we're too religious and we want to paint it as godly. And then we're surprised when God allows the religiousness of people to crumble too. Why would God allow that church to close? Because God has not been in that church for a long time. And we're expecting God to swoop in and take all the flesh and all the idolatry that has been laid up in that church of men and of stuff and of ritual that has been long replacing godliness. And we expect him to swoop in and just make it work anyway? No. God allows our failure. When we do life our way and not God's way, he allows it all to crumble. And we cannot expect him to turn it around. Which takes me to my last point. When we fail, God allows trial. God allows our failure. But God also, number three, God gives grace. So this is the weirdest end to the book. So we saw the fall of Jerusalem. We backtracked and watched as God purposefully ended this book on a downer. I mean, we almost had a slight moment of justice as we were in the last couple chapters, talking about how, yeah, that's right, Egypt and Babylon and Edom, they are wicked. I thought so. And he's not going to let us end the book that way. No, no, he's not. He comes back to us and reminds us that judgment begins at the house of God. And he sees the fall of Jerusalem, but now he's going to really, really end the book with this tiny little story. Verse 31. It came to pass in the 37th year of the captivity of Jehoiachin. Now, I'm going to remind us who he is, king of Judah. In the 12th month, in the 25th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, lifted up the head of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him forth out of prison. He spake kindly unto him. He set his throne above the throne of the kings that were with him in Babylon. He changed his prison garments. He did continually eat bread before him all the days of his life. And for his diet, there was a continual diet given him of the king of Babylon every day, a portion until the day of his death, all the days of his life. The end. What? Why is that there? Well, we know it's important because it is here. But what's also fascinating is that this is exactly how 2 Kings ends. It's exactly how it ends. As we're reading the history of the kings, we get to the end, Babylon falls, we read the same story, and also, by the way, Jehoiachin is in captivity. And the king takes him out of prison, gives him a position, and gives him a seat at his table for the rest of his life. And 2 Kings ends. Both books end exactly the same. Why is this the very last thing we read in the book? For a couple different reasons. This is all balanced out. This whole book is about the failure of the people of Israel. They were given great opportunities to flourish as God's people, and better than the people around them. They had God's law, they had God's word, they had the temple, they had an opportunity to flourish, and they have forfeited all of it in their sin. But this book ends with a reminder of their demise, and then it really ends with a brief story of goodness and undeserved favor. We're actually surprised it happens at all. Why does the king of Babylon bother to go in the pits of the prison and pull out one of the kings of his enemies? And why does he bother to give him a position? And why does he bother to give him a place at his table and gave him a really good meal for the rest of his life? And we all are wondering, why would that happen? And then the book ends, and we never hear about it again. Why is this here? Because it's a reminder that in spite of how awful the book of Jeremiah is for their own fault, that God is still gracious. A couple different things. Letter A, he's great. He gives grace by helping those who do not deserve it. By helping those who do not deserve it. Now, I know that's the definition of grace, but I want to pull 2 points out here. Who is Jehoiachin? Remember, the deportations of the children of Israel took place under 3 different kings. One of them was Jehoiakim, bad, bad king. He reigned for 11 years, and halfway through his reign, they took a bunch of them captive. The second deportation was him, Jehoiachin. He reigned for 3 months. And he was the first king to be taken himself to captivity. And he was evil. He was wicked. In fact, he was so wicked, the Bible emphasizes his wickedness. I gave you a passage in Jeremiah 22. It says, this man, Coniah, sometimes Jehoiachin is called Jeconiah, it's the same guy, a despised, broken idol. Is he a vessel wherein is no pleasure? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into a land which they know not? O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling anymore in Judah. Wow, that is his legacy. He is terrible, he will be childless, no one will reign on the throne after him. My soul. But this is why the end of the book is so important. The worst of the worst. God gives a place, a position, and a seat at the table. What did he do?
Nothing.
Because God commends his love toward us. And now while we're sinners, Christ dies for us. See, this is what's so hard about the Bible. We want to paint God as mean and angry and dictatorial, even though everything that happens to us we deserve. But then we only look at the New Testament, we see only his love and his grace as if law doesn't matter. And both of those things have to be put next to each other. God is holy and he is just, and we ruin our own lives, but in spite of that, God is willing to be good when we are not. And that's how he ends this book, because God's willing to give grace to people who don't deserve it. Remember, okay, the book of Lamentations is a book Jeremiah writes, and I spared you, I thought about walking through this book after, but I didn't think we could handle it anymore. Lamentations is written by Jeremiah as he watches Jerusalem fall. This is his emotional reaction to the fall of Jerusalem. And in the middle of this book, almost the exact middle of this book, he says this, "This I recall to my mind, therefore have I hope." It's of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. His compassions fail not, they are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. He writes that in Lamentations because he remembers that in spite of us crumbling our own lives, God's willing to take up the pieces and build it again when we don't deserve it. There is no answer to the questions we're asking as we finish Jeremiah. Why this guy? Why did this happen? There's no answers to that question except for the goodness of God and God's promises. That takes us to letter B, and we'll be done. God gives grace by keeping his promises and his plans for our good. For our good. Now, remember, it's not just randomly for Jehoiachin. He doesn't just pick up a random human and say, I'm going to be good to him just to display my goodness, although that would have been fine. In fact, in Romans 5:8, when it says God commended his love, we usually say commend means show or demonstrate. That King James word that's used there in that era of English actually means to display. Like when you set a diamond on a setting. You don't just throw your wife a diamond. You put a setting on it and you commend it. God wanted to not just commend his love, but he also did it for Jehoiachin on purpose. And I really don't have time to read all these passages, but I kind of have to, so you have to bear with me. Remember, the climax of this book is not at the end. The most important part of this book, like some Hebrew books are, is in the middle, because he wants you to go to it, and then he wants you to go away from it. In the middle of the book is the whole section about God's grace and his plan. When he's sending them into captivity in Jeremiah 29, he says, I know the thoughts I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. So you'll call upon me, and ye shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. You shall seek me and find me when you shall search for me with all your heart. He reminds them, I'm not sending you here to destroy you. I'm sending you here to bring you to the best possible end. And how is he going to do that? He's going to do that by reminding them that they are failures. And the only way they're going to enjoy their relationship with God is not when they are good enough, but when God chooses to change them from the inside out. Remember that? And so he gives them the new covenant, Jeremiah 31. This covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. I will teach no more, they will teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, hey, know the Lord, for they shall all know me. From the least of them to the greatest of them, saith the Lord, I'll forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. And how is he going to do that? Chapter 33. In those days and at that time will I cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and justice, righteousness in the land. In those days Judah shall be saved, Jerusalem shall dwell safely, and this is the name wherewith she shall be called, the Lord our righteousness. This is his plan that he was doing. Everything he was doing, the nation of Israel, is not to throw them away in spite of the fact that they deserved it, but was to bring them to an end where he could, through them, have grace on not only them, but on everybody else. And so that's why when you open up the book of Matthew, chapter number 1, and you want to read about the life of Jesus, You start with a genealogy, and you're like, oh, I thought it was done Old Testament stuff. Why am I reading a list of names again? Well, in the middle of that genealogy, Matthew 1 is trying to remind us who Jesus is. Remember, because you're not an island, genealogies are important because you belong to the family and the line from which you came. And in the middle of that genealogy, you have Josiah, who begat Jechonias. That's that guy. And his brethren, the other bad ones, Zedekiah and Jehoiakim, about the time they were carried away to Babylon. After they were brought to Babylon, Jechonias begot Salathiel, and Salathiel begot Zerubbabel. So right here in the middle of the genealogy, you have this guy, Jechoniah. His grandson was Zerubbabel, who brought the people back to the land and built the temple under the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah. What is the book of Jeremiah telling us? That we're failures. And we are unable to be religious enough or good enough on our own. And we need grace and we need Jesus. And in spite of how much of a failure we are, in light of the glorious gospel of grace, we can be changed into his image. Even though our story is one of a lot of negativity and a lot of failure that we've brought on ourselves. When we are not good enough, God is. And no matter how much we fail, God is still willing to set us in a place where we can see his power working through our lives. The book of Jeremiah is so hard, but it is so important. Because if we do not understand that part of our story, we will not understand the gospel. And we will not understand his grace the way that we should. I gave you a passage in Psalm 106. I want you to read it really quickly. It doesn't add a whole lot to the point, but it helps us see the emotional response to this very thing. God allows our trials that we do to ourselves. God allows the failures we bring on ourselves, but God is giving grace. And when we live in light of that grace, then we'll see his power. And that takes us to where we're going to go next week. You ready? I was going to put a note in the bulletin, but I knew where I was going, but I didn't make a slide for it, so I had nothing to put into the bulletin. I've been praying about this for a couple months because Jeremiah is so hard and so law-filled. We have to balance that out by reminding ourselves about how we are not good enough on our own and we are not religious enough on our own. That's not what we need. We need God's grace in our life and to live in his spirit. And so we're going to go to the book of Galatians next week, which is so short, right? 6 chapters, it'll be like a breeze. We'll be done by spring. And so I think that'll be a help to you. So I'm looking forward to that. And so be here next week as we begin the book of Galatians, No Other Gospel is what we're going to be calling the subtitle for that. So I'm looking forward to that. And I hope this was a help to you. Everything's downhill from there. This is the longest book of the Bible. Nothing else is going to compare to it. Everything will be shorter. You're welcome. Look forward to it.